Radio Gorgeous. Listen anywhere, anytime.
Me acompaña la fuerza de siete dragones de fuego. Navegación celeste y estudiada técnica de vuelo. Viento a favor, expandirse en todas direcciones. Siempre perdiendo, preludiando tiempos mejores. Aunque batalle, yo no quiero desafíos. Máximo respeto, dame lo que es mío. No existe competición para tanta hipocresía. Somos barceros remando hacia nuestra propia deriva. Quien engaña no gana.
Welcome to Gorgeous Gossip. I'm Josephine Pembroke.
And I'm Donna Freed.
So today we're interviewing an artist later. Who is that?
Agathe Sorel. She's a Hungarian artist. She was an absolute revolutionary. Seriously. Worked with plastic, perspex, as a sculpture item before it was even, you know, thought of.
Fantastic. So I can't wait for that. Now, first of all, your week. Old Donner, what you been up to, old Donner?
I actually had time to do a little magazine reading. Oh. When do I have time to do that?
I hope you were lying horizontal while you did it.
I was. I was a lady of leisure. So yeah, I was catching up on some old Vanity Fair. So not the current one with Angelina Jolie, but the one I was reading the Jennifer Lawrence interview. And I was struck by two things in the interview. The first thing, I don't know if you know, there were pictures of her that she had taken naked, you know, some selfies, naked selfies or sexy selfies she had taken and sent to her boyfriend, and her cloud was hacked and they were available all over. I don't know if they still are or whatnot. I didn't come across them. But she was extremely upset that even people who were, you know, who are quite close to her, friends and family said, oh yeah, I looked at them. And she was infuriated by that, and really affected by this when they went viral in public, etc. She felt it was a huge violation. And, you know, her feeling was, I didn't invite you to look at me naked. And the thing that occurred to me was that if I had run across them, I would have looked at them. And it made me think, just because we can, should we? And I think just because things are available to us, we think we should. Because, you know, why? Because we can. You know, that's what they always say about technology. And, you know, your kids come to say, well, you know, you can do that now. You can do that. I'm like, yeah, but should I? Is it a good thing to do? And I don't think we ask ourselves that question anymore. You know, especially
we're not self-censoring when it comes to the internet.
Nope. And okay, so here's the question: would you have looked at them if you had come across them?
I don't know. I mean, I'm not. To be honest, I'm not that interested in her. I think it was somebody that is more. You know, if it was pictures of, I don't know, someone that's more my age group or something, I might be quite. You know, Liz Hurley or something. You know?
Okay, but do you think you would have a right to look at Liz Hurley's sex?
Well, I do. God, of course I haven't got the right. No, you haven't got the right.
But I think we own celebrities in some way. They've put themselves in the public eye.
Yes.
Therefore, you know, they somehow deserve this exposure.
She has got a public job, and her job is selling herself. She also does probably quite a lot of films where she has to be quite nude in them. So it's sort of, she's already kind of opened the door, the floodgates, and said, I'm not a very... You know, I am a public person, not a private person.
Yeah, I mean, when you say that, it just makes it, oh, well, you were wearing that underwear. You must have asked for it.
Yeah.
You know, it's that kind of thing. And I think we don't think about that anymore in our thirst. And, you know, newspapers always defend themselves by saying, oh, it was in the public interest.
Yeah.
Was it in the public interest? It was certainly, well, it was in the public as in the public was
intrigued.
Interested. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The public was certainly interested, but it doesn't mean that we are bettered for it and we had a right to know.
No.
I don't think you can argue that in this case. The second thing she said made me so sad was that she said the reason why she did it, she said, well, you know, I had a long distance relationship and your boyfriend's either going to be looking at you or looking at porn. Like, those are the only two choices. If you're, you know, if you're in a long distance relationship, those are your choices. You know, he's certainly going to be looking and jerking off at something. Maybe the thought of you. I don't know.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Whatever happened to that?
What happened to imagination?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, he has met you, you know, but and the fact that she was very, you know, she considered that a fact. was very sad to me.
Yes, and I'm wondering whether it's him that said, darling, will you send me a picture I can jerk off to, because otherwise I will be looking at porn, or whether she just thought, I'll cover all bases, you know.
Well, no, isn't it?
Porn.
You know, you're away from each other. Oh, I miss you so much, baby. Let me just smell it, you know.
Well, you could send you pants, couldn't you?
Yeah, exactly. That would be, don't open them at the office. Ooh, I've got her pen.
Yeah, there's all sorts of things you can do that don't involve technology. But then again, I hate to say it, it's again sort of, would we have done it? And, you know, it's because we're a bit older and we're in a relationship. We're not having to pull, you know, we're not having to send a picture of our tits, you know. I mean, you know, you never know. It might happen again to us in our lives. We might be...
sexting away.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, my God, sending
nude...
nude selfies of my withered thighs.
Well, the thing is, I would send ones of somebody else and maybe Photoshop.
Who would you send? Liz Hurley.
Yeah. Well, no, what I mean is that I'd send... This is the kind of, if ever, God forbid, I did split up with my partner, you know. That's what I'm just saying. You know, I might get into it. You never know.
You never say never.
RadioGorgeous.com.
Now, that's what I've been up to. Obviously, taking selfies from good angles. And you?
I have been to Spain because it was half term. And I went to my daughter's godmother's gay wedding.
Oh, fab.
She's marrying not her long-term partner. She's going out for a few years. And the brides wore matching white gowns. Well, off-white.
Yeah. Oh, it takes the argument out of it.
And the location was a beach in Spain, and it was 27 degrees. It was really hot. The brides arrived literally across the bay with two people pedaling the pedalo, and they were standing behind. Yeah.
No way. Yes. That has to be hands down the best wedding arrival I have ever heard of. You know, there were the chariots and horse-drawn carriages. No. Yeah. Pedalo!
Exactly.
That's
exactly.
Awesome! Yeah. I love that.
And so it was quite tricky getting off it, you know, in the sort of outfits. But they took their shoes off and then their feet got a bit sandy. But that was rather nice because that's what they wanted in a beach wedding. And the funny thing about the beach was it is a nudist beach. So even when you were sitting down at the wedding in a sort of kind of horseshoe shape, everyone had seats. And you know, I'm wearing a fascinator. I'm really dressed up. And then I look over... When the brides are saying, you know, I will. And then you look over and you see this man standing with his hands on his hips in the water. You know how kind of exhibitionists really like a much more, I should say nudists. I guess.
Naturists.
Yeah. It's like they want you to see it. Mm. You know, there is something in them. It's not just about being free. It's about being free and visual and easy. So it was quite funny.
It just put the visual back into my head of when we went to a nude beach in Corfu.
Yeah.
And there was this couple who were obviously older parents and playing football on the beach with their son, and everything was going this way and that way and this way and that way.
Not a pretty sight. Too much jingling. Too much movement.
Yes, exactly. And yet also sitting there were these... you know, aged walruses who'd obviously been there for like the last month. You know, they were like nut brown, didn't move, large slabs of...
hide.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And then us whiteies.
Exactly. Were you nude?
We were nude.
Fantastic. Yes. Getting burnt. Anyway.
Yeah, but not as pale as the
English
people.
Back to you. Wedding. Anyway, so it was brilliant. My husband did the father of the bride speech, and he incorporated three songs from The Sound of Music into it, changing the words, you know, making it more outrageous. And it was a beautiful lunch, and it was very Spanish, and it was really good fun. And then the next day they had a post-wedding party at this incredible villa, which is literally on the rocks. You're on the edge of, and then it has an infinity pool over the rocks. It's like being in a James Bond film.
Oh, fantastic.
And they had entertainment.
Yes.
They had a singer, and I suddenly said, Adele's arrived! Someone said, it's a surprise. I went, oh my God, I'm sorry, but I just thought it was Adele, and it was an Adele lookalike.
Ah.
And I had a really good chat with her. And I said, oh, you know, how is it being Adele on the Costa del Sol or whatever? And she said, well, it's great because I'm the only one. I said, well, what's wrong with London or England? She said, there's too many.
There's too there's many looky-likeys.
There's loads of Adeles out
it's
there.
It's lousy yeah. with Adeles.
Yeah, exactly. But she was brilliant and sang lots of different songs. And then she let me take the microphone.
Let you? Or did you give her, twist her arm a little bit there?
Yeah, I did.
Did you wrest it out of her hand?
And I sang Hey Big Spender.
It is your song. Yeah. Go on, give us a little.
Do I have to?
Yes, you have to now.
So let me get right to the point. I don't pop my cork for every man I see. Hey, big spender, spend a little time with me. Da-da-da-da-da. Ow!
Awesome. Woo!
Oh, you're very
She's
kind.
Back on the stage.
Okay, now, do you want to introduce the darling guest?
Yes, we have Sandra Higgins of Sandra Higgins Art and Agathe Sorel, who she made spend a year cleaning her studio before this wonderful retrospective.
So we have the prints, some of them relating to the sculpture, some of them, of course, very, very early.
Yes, and I see 1968.
Yes.
So and that a year younger than me.
Yes.
And yes, where were you living when you were doing in 1968 when you were doing these?
No, that
prints?
Was in London, but in Fulham.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. And the earliest work goes back to 58 when I was working with Hayter, and those are in sleeves, which I'll show you quickly. And this is the Gates of Hell, rather romantic little watercolor of a guy carrying the woman into the sea.
Mm, yeah.
And then the guy got sort of dismissed.
And, he had served his purpose.
Yes. And I kept with the woman. And, you know, this is the head, this is the legs, this is the chest, all engraved on a flat surface, but slotted into 3D. Yeah. So that is how I proceeded.
Yeah.
This again is Amazon with one breast.
Yeah, I was really drawn to that one.
Yes.
One, the
yes.
colors.
Yes.
Uh-huh. And it looks almost alien, you know, like our
yes.
idea of an alien.
Yeah. Isn't that strange? This is what the guy said from London City Live. This some sort of crazy alien culture, you know.
Yeah.
These totem figures, yes.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. And does that resonate with you, that, you know, an Amazonian woman with one breast would be an alien?
Yeah, but the titles usually come later.
Yeah.
You know, except, for example, the Macho the Cock.
Macho the Cock.
Yes.
So fantastic.
You know, cockroaches are not too intelligent, and they don't know that they are looking at themselves. And they just look and say, what a handsome fellow. Yeah. So this is what I started from.
Is that frequently how you work, from a watercolor?
I don't do drawings for sculpture. I just put it together in space because it has to work from every angle, from the materials I have at hand, and then the ideas develop, you see?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it's against the wall because this is being used as gallery
exactly,
space
yes.
at the moment, but
yes.
it's normally your
it
studio.
It should be.
It would be here
yes,
in the center, and
yes.
you'd be working all around it.
Yes, yes,
very
indeed.
Actively.
Yes, and especially the welding, you see, that I did here, but not so much with the others. If you come around here, you would see that this is the motorbike, and the cockroach looks at himself in real mirrors, you see? And has a headlamp and a tail lamp of the motorbike. And, of course, this could be turned into, you know, in different directions.
Yeah.
And, you know, it gives different reflections.
If someone had this in their home, would you recommend that they regularly move it?
All these pieces work when you walk around them, and the lines seem to bulge,
mm-hmm. and you know, the atmosphere.
Yeah, they have a very different shape. Yeah, we're looking down on it now, sort of, and it has a completely surprisingly different shape than when you're standing back from it.
Yes, and especially the pieces which are, for example, this one. You know, it's actually the lines bulge and give a different reflection when you walk around it.
And is that partly the property of Perspex?
Yes, but also because I work inside the Perspex and not on top of it. A lot of people just sort of print on it and draw on top of it, and it doesn't work because, you know, it has to be inside the material.
Wow. Okay. Yes, because that's, I'm just looking here, because you're really seeing through.
Yes.
Something which, as you say, makes the lines distort and bulge and blur because they're inside there.
And also the lighting changes a lot. Yes. I'm surprised myself. For example, in the night when we had the lights off and that there was just a sort of beam of light on this one, which I don't know where it came from, you know, outside, or maybe it was the moon, because we get the moon shine here. You know, it gave a kind of configuration which I haven't seen before. I was really surprised. Yeah.
Oh, that's exciting.
Yeah. Because you are, to some extent, interested in the feminist angle, that most of it is autobiographical.
Okay.
You see?
And in what way?
Direct experience, lots of feminine shapes, and the themes.
For example, the man taking the woman into the sea.
Exactly. Yes.
And then he's dismissed, and you're left with the woman.
Yes.
In the sea.
Yes. Yes. And this is Titania, with the S. Head and hand there, and that is again a very sort of feminine shape, and referring quite a lot of it to my own experiences. This too is a rather feminine shape.
Yes.
Uh-huh. So
sort of like a scooped, just like a hanging basket chair kind of.
Yes, indeed. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's very feminine. So, the hips, the sway.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yes.
Uh-huh. Yes, and blue snaking fallopian tubes, perhaps. Something along those lines.
Well, yeah.
Wow. Yeah. What strikes me also is that some of your pieces are really densely colored, and others, you know, you're working a lot with transparent, you know, clear perspex and just black and white or black and clear.
Yes.
Where are those? How does that come about in your?
Well, I just picked up the material, that color.
Right.
Usually.
Okay.
Yes.
I found green. I'll use green. Let's see what I can do with that.
Well, I had this scrap place, you know, mm-hmm. and that was my only secret because that is somewhere out in, Tooting or something like that. And they. Collect these perspex objects for scrap from all over the world, and some of them are huge, you know, like an aquarium with a wall of that thick. And,
so it's like a perspex reclamation place.
Yes, they break it up and reprocess it.
Okay.
And then they have these big cranes, and I would stand under that crane, like, please don't drop that.
I want that one.
Exactly, I want that one. Happened with this one, yes.
Other people go shopping for, you know, things. You're like, I want that giant piece of perspex, please.
Yes.
How fun.
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah. And then I bring it home, and this one is called Igor the Goat. So this is the goat's head.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
With its horn engraved on flat plastic.
Yeah.
And this is the Canarian wine press, which is carved out of wood like a corkscrew. So this was in the watercolor. And then I put these two flat objects in 3D and light it and work on it, etc. So this is how it developed.
You were talking about working with the mathematician and sort of exploring shapes and different views of them and different versions of them. And I'm wondering how that translates from your two-dimensional work, what that gives you in terms of your view of something, and then how you translate it to 3D.
For example, this one here, which is, I call it the spa. I made this triangle structure and engraved it. But then I found the green piece, and also I added prints, digital prints. Okay. But that was quite a long time ago. That would be very unusual. And also the bottle, because it's, it's a spa, which, a found object, and also a glass, two glasses, which I put prints inside them.
It's interesting, so it's those two convex mirrors.
Yes.
Right-angle convex mirrors. And they're fused together in a disc, and they're surrounded on either side by perspex pillars, which are reflecting. So it really is when you move around it.
Yes, yes, yes.
It totally changes.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Moves with
yes,
you.
Yes. Yeah. And I have this sculpture out there, which is sort of unfinished, but
which is in the garden.
Which is in the garden.
And the cat is walking by.
Yeah, yeah. So that is also from pre-pressed materials. You can see it better from the mezzanine. But, this is all a prefab.
Right. And are you working on it outside?
Well, this was my son's request, which I, quite a long time ago, he had a lovely little house and beautiful area, but a terribly ugly, slatted concrete wall. And I sort of took this request quite seriously and, started working from pre-pressed, prefabricated shapes. Some of it is engraved, but some of it is,
There's a do not enter sort of triangle shape.
Exactly, yes. So it all almost all prefabricated shapes, except the line in the middle, which is engraved.
Yeah, wow. And so when does the commission get to his house?
It didn't. His then girlfriend declared that it would make the house unsaleable. Probably true. <No. laughs>
Unique but unsellable.
Yes.
All right. Okay. So now it's in your garden. So
yes.
Fair enough. Right.
The prints here, which are in the portfolios.
Oh, right. Yes.
These go back this is more or less chronological.
Right.
So it would, this is, as you can see, this is 65.
Yes.
And some of these are even earlier.
Oh, wow.
These are from Hayter's period. So you could see the difference between what I did with him.
Yes. And was this was on brass plates, was it?
No, zinc plates.
Zinc plates. They're beautiful, but they're sort of, but you can tell it's on metal.
Yes, of
course.
Yeah,
it's very, very...
Yes, and the color.
Metallic quality.
And this is done in Paris, this is where the line engraving interest came in. Mm-hmm. But as soon as I got back to London, 62, I went right through the metal and, opened it all up.
Yeah.
So...
That has such a... As you say, going right through the metal, there's a corrosive quality there, sort of breaking through.
Yes.
You were on the move.
Yeah. So this was going to be a part of the Le Balcon series, and
they are very beautiful. What do you see the similarities? Do you see the journey that you went from here to what you're doing now?
Yes, yes.
And all the way through.
Yes. This is what Sandra asked me to do, to catalogue all the work which is here in the house, which was a lot, and see how many of them I have, and, you know, whatever, which I had no idea.
This was a good task for you.
Yes. It took me a year because I have 52 big planches drawers full of stuff, and I had to sort them out, and, you know.
So the process of doing this retrospective has been, I mean, that's been a journey in and of itself for you.
Exactly, because there was stuff that I didn't even remember.
Wow.
And sketches and, you know, good ideas and whatever, you see.
Has finding old things that you hadn't done anything with, has that come into your work now? Has that reinvigorated certain things?
I have so many things that I have, you know, in my sketchbooks and collections, which I haven't actually pursued, and there are just too many ideas even now, you know.
Because just the sculpture out in the garden, that middle red line.
Yeah, this is very early. This is a little bit later when things have opened up.
Yes.
Using photogravure for the first time.
Okay.
Which was, believe it or not, you know, trade secret. You couldn't use it unless you were a client of Kodak, and only for the newspapers. Yeah.
Wow.
It was copyrighted.
The whole process.
The whole process, yes.
Wow.
And then I found ways of getting around it. This is Madame Guillotine from a market series. Because you have to look at this.
Yes, this way, in landscape.
Yeah, because, you know, she sat at the bottom of the gallows and knitting, and these were all headless figures.
Yes, the shirts of the market stall and bow ties.
Yes,
all fitted in there. And again, very layered.
Yes.
With all the different processes and things you're working with.
Her body is made of coat hangers.
Yes, I see that.
And these are shirts.
And
that's the slippers. Yeah. And all.
With the little ties. Yes. Okay, yes.
So the bamboo construction came about.
Around the studio, sort of, it almost looks like super artistic fencing, or something you'd see in a fashion, you know, in a department store, you know, a clothing clothing store. Cause
derives from the bamboo scaffolding that they used in India, and they use it on very, very tall buildings, skyscrapers, mosques, etc. And the scaffolding is made out of bamboo, just roped together.
Yeah.
And these gangways in the sky serve as a, you know, the women take up all these heavy materials and stuff on their heads in their beautiful saris, and they often fall.
Yeah.
And this construction is in their memory.
Yeah.
And this is why I'm using the sari, Indian sari material. Yes. And the bamboo and the rope, to commemorate the, you know,
and all of the sari material. Some of it's on the ground.
Yes,
it has fallen.
Yes,
and some looks as if it is falling.
Yes,
cascading down.
Yes.
My weekday fix, darling. It has to be Radio Gorgeous.
Agathe Sorel. Welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
We've just had a walk around your stunning Forest Hill studio and home, where there's a retrospective of your work. I want to, for people who don't know who you are and aren't familiar with your work, I want to tell them a bit about you, because you, as well as an interesting artist story, you have an interesting personal story, which are... They're very intertwined.
Yes.
But so you were born in Hungary.
Yes, indeed, yes.
Yeah.
And I went to college there in the communist era when social realism ruled. And you had to make very, very realistic drawings and paintings and not use, for example, black outlines, because that was pessimistic. You couldn't imagine the kind of rules that the social realism imposed on us.
And when did you, and under what circumstances did you leave Hungary?
Well, just after the Hungarian uprising in 56, my mother, stepfather, and myself left in an ambulance, which my father organized as a doctor. Right. And we left the country and through Vienna arrived to England. And I had some relations here, but I didn't stay with them very much. And I went to Camberwell School of Art, as it then was, now it is Camberwell College, and spent a year and a half there, where I met some very interesting people.
And what was that like? I mean, was it, okay, so you're coming from a very stringent social realist, didactic sort of ideology of what you can paint, what you can do. And what were the most startling differences?
There wasn't much.
Really?
In Camberwell at the time, there wasn't very much because it was Houston School Realism, which wasn't very different from social realism. We had to draw stuffed animals and cubes and that sort of thing. But there were some very interesting people who were even then doing interesting work.
Right.
Michael Rothenstein, Robert Medley, Kitai. I met Anthony Gross, a fellow Hungarian, and Julian Trevelyan at Royal College, who were all working on very interesting, doing some very interesting new work, and were absolutely in tune with possibilities. And they advised me to go to Hayter.
Okay.
So I could have gone to the Royal College where they, I was offered a place, but I thought I'd go to Hayter. And luckily, I got the Gulbenkian scholarship, which was amazing, for 2 years to finance all that.
And that was in Paris?
That was in Paris, yes.
And it was interesting to me just hearing you say that now, because those were all men you mentioned.
Yes, as it happens, yes.
In the art world in general, it's very, and especially at that time, very male-oriented.
Very male-oriented. There was, of course, Mary Fedden, Julian Trevelyan's wife, who, you know, we had a close contact with both of them. But as you say, there were not many women, yes.
Mm-hmm. And so what was the experience like in Paris at Hayter?
That was amazing. That everything opened up suddenly. And, of course, it wasn't easy for me because I was still indoctrinated with the social realism.
Or the realism of Camberwell.
Or the realism of Camberwell. And it took me a while to understand what modern art is about.
And also to understand yourself as an artist.
Yes.
Without those strictures.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So after those 2 years, and you say things really opened up.
Well, Hayter was a wonderful teacher, and he taught us his technique and also tutored all of us individually. And we were all invited to exhibitions of very well-known artists, like Picasso, Miro, or Vasarely, whatever. As a matter of course, all the students were invited.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were in touch with what was happening.
Mm.
And that was very, very enlightening.
Mm. So did you always have the idea that you were an artist?
Yes.
From an early age, like that?
Very, absolutely, yes.
Right. So you were always clear on that?
Yes.
It was just how it was going to happen?
Yes. Okay. It's like my little granddaughter when she's quite good at art, and if people ask her, do you want to become an artist? She says, I am an artist. Just,
oh, lovely. Yeah. And that was you as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. You were an artist. That was yes. That was it.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And so you. So after Paris, what year did you come back to London?
1960.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And okay. Then I was able to buy a little house through, I sold some work and I got some money from my father, and I managed to get a mortgage, which was very, very rare, because women were not allowed to have mortgages at that time. You needed a father or a husband or somebody to guarantee for you. So Fulham Borough Council was really way ahead of giving me a mortgage at all.
And you got it from the council?
Yes.
Oh,
from for the promise of two jobs. I was promised a job at Camberwell and Goldsmiths, and eventually at Maidstone as well. But that was part-time.
Yeah, so you were teaching part-time
I was
to
teaching
support
part-time,
yourself.
Yes. Yeah. And, of course, we had to let most of the house upstairs and stay in this narrow little place downstairs, which was a studio and reception and a living area and everything all together. There was a little conservatory which we built for acids and workshop.
Do I understand correctly that you went to the United States and Mexico? And
oh, yes. I went something like 13 times before I even got the Churchill Fellowship. And it was a yearly visit. Mm. And it was very interesting to see what's happening there. And also I took my prints with me to sell.
Mm-hmm. And pay your way as you go.
Yes. And it was much more open than it is now. You could just walk into a museum and talk with the director or the head of the printmaking and show your work and explain, and they would buy stuff or send you to meet other artists or other critics or whatever. So it is much, much more open. It just doesn't exist anymore.
And some of the things that you were doing, you're saying every time you started doing something new, it caused like a big sensation.
It caused a lot of controversy because it was against every sort of principle that they held. It was institutional. It was from the part of artists who worked already in stone or metal or something like that.
And this is your work in Perspex, are you talking about? Or can
no,
we
everything. Okay. I think
can we talk, sort of how you got into Perspex and why, and sort of the reaction to that more specifically?
This was so controversial with members of staff and also the establishment.
Why?
That I got instantly dismissed in the middle of the term. I don't know why, but it...
Really?
Yeah, and it happened several times, that sort of reaction against my work, because it was so unusual and unconventional.
So they dismissed you from your teaching job.
Yes.
because of your exhibition?
To some extent, yes.
To some extent, yeah.
Yeah, this is why I called it space engravings and not sculpture. Out of self-defense.
Really?
Yeah.
So, but was this show in particular billed as a sculpture show?
Well, no, it had also prints.
Okay.
Maybe one or two watercolors, but right. It was prints and sculpture. Gotcha. Because the head of art history thought it would be interesting.
And so people who were working in more traditional... using more traditional materials like wood, like
metal
and
metal or
stone.
Yeah, that's right. Yes.
Limestone or yes. Whatever it is.
So I thought that if I called them space engravings and not sculpture, I would sort of escape some of that.
I don't imagine that worked.
No. No.
You tried to sidestep it,
yeah.
But no.
But when Tessa Sidey, who wrote my catalogue from the Birmingham Museum, it was 6 years ago, She came here about 13 times, and then she said, you know, it's about time that you call the spade, and, you know, this is sculpture.
Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I imagine, I mean, because looking at some of these, and as we were talking before, like when I'm looking like this, you know, this alien landscape. When did you start working with these, as you called them then, space engravings? But when did you start working on these sculptures?
Quite early. Quite early.
Like in the 60s?
Yes, early 60s, yes. Mm.
So I imagine it must have been, I mean, you can't imagine it was shocking.
It was, yes, yeah. Yes.
Was that part of the excitement, or for you it was just, no, this is, it was exciting and it was a way to, exactly. I want to work this way.
Exactly, yes.
So were you surprised and by the reaction?
Yes, I was disappointed. Yeah, obviously. Yes.
Yeah, well, you think everyone's going to be as excited as you are.
Yes. Mel Gooding, who opened this exhibition, pointed out that this was European thinking and mind space.
Okay, yeah.
And thought was absolutely up to the standard of Malevich and Alisitsky and Naum Gabor and Mohol Nagy.
Yes.
And his idea was to somehow show that, possibly, that they'd written.
You know, you're being very revolutionary, and some people are celebrating it. To what extent do you think, if it were a man doing your work, would it have been more celebrated? Do you think that your gender had anything to do with it?
Not really.
Art establishment
yes,
being stodgy and traditional and, you know, not like in plastic.
No.
Plastic was not a serious material.
That's
but
right.
I think that's part of it.
Like Fablon, for example, that I showed you, made these prints with Fablon. That was considered a very cheap, vulgar material.
Yeah.
The fact that Picasso used, collages and of all kinds of things, and newspapers and fabrics, and even Matisse used fabrics a lot, you know. It didn't register.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yes. Yeah, it's you're not a serious artist because you're not working in the serious, you know, with serious artist materials.
Exactly.
Yes. Right. Got it. And so, throughout all this time, you're dismissed from one teaching position, but obviously you got
teaching
positions.
Oh yes, I have and kept it on for.
I would think that that's a very different headspace from doing your own work and then turning into the teacher.
Well, no, that was absolutely essential to have the students, you know.
Oh, wonderful.
Because they were so talented and full of ideas, and I gave a lot of ideas away. And strangely enough, once I've given that idea away and they were using it, I felt that I had to move on. I had to do something else.
All right, it fueled your creativity
as well.
Like, oh, I can't do that because it'll be derivative, even though it was mine.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
It'll be perceived as derivative. Who were some of your students?
I mentioned David Ferry, Maggie Hambling. You met Angela Wright the other day here. Also a very, very good artist. And Annalisa Colombara. Jakob Busidan, all very well-known artists now of their own right.
It occurs to me that through you, they got a far better teaching experience and learning experience than you had in the very stringent social realism and then the stringent realism that you encountered in school until you went to Paris.
Yes.
So it's another way of satisfying, because we were talking about earlier that your 2D work satisfies something different than your 3D work, and sort of your teaching work sort of satisfies something, you know, something different than your making work.
It was absolutely essential for me to have these contacts.
Yeah.
And also when Michael Rothenstein, Julian Trevelyan, and myself, the five of us, founded the Printmakers Council because printmaking was not taken seriously at the time. Mm-hmm. And there might have been just one little Star Wheel Etching Press at the corner of the studio.
Because again, it was painting and drawing was everything.
Exactly. Right. And through perseverance, through the Printmakers Council, we managed to get printmaking acknowledged. And now they have separate departments, very good equipment, materials, everything. So that was very positive.
Fantastic. Wow, thank you so much, Agathe. This has been wonderful. Mm-hmm. And I want to bring in now Sandra Higgins. How did this retrospective come about? Because Agathe said you made her work for a year, going through all of her drawers and closets and clean up her studio and wreak havoc in her life.
A real task maker.
Uh-huh.
That's yes. Right. Yes.
Well, Agathe nodding for anyone who can't see.
I know. Well, I met her through David Ferry, and so she insisted that I come and see her in Forest Hill. I didn't really know what to expect, and when I came in, I was overwhelmed with the talent, but underwhelmed with the a bit of the chaos. So I said, to her, you have to have an archive, and not just because of me, Agathe, but you have a living history here.
Yeah.
And you have to record it for all of us. You should do a monograph. People should know about this, and you have to do this in a quite orderly way. So to my surprise and pleasure, she did. And when I came back, everything was changed. It was all archived. I think we have 40 pages of the archive or something like that. 250 items, I'm not quite sure. Not only that, but her husband, Gabo, had rearranged the studio. Everything was framed. So I was really, really pleased. And she's just pulled up her socks and shown us, therefore, the amazing talent she is. But personally, what I saw in her was I've always been very, very enamored of Hayter. And his work as a printmaker. And I think she didn't emphasize enough what an honor it was to work with him in Paris. Mm-hmm. Agathe may say there was no discrimination, and it didn't matter that it was all men in the school or all men being recognized, but she was a pioneer. Now, she said she's not a feminist. She doesn't go burn her bra, mm-hmm. but she just goes forward in a men's world and makes herself known and makes herself equal.
Thank you so much, Agathe. Thank you so much, Donna. Thank you so much for everyone that came on to the show this week. This has been a Radio Gorgeous production for Radio Gorgeous 2014, produced and presented by Donna and Josephine, and edited by Cassie. Thank you so much for listening.
La fuerza de siete dragones de fuego, navegación celeste y estudiada técnica de vuelo, viento a favor, expandirse en todas direcciones, siempre perdiendo, preludiando tiempos mejores. Aunque batalla, yo no quiero desafíos, máximo respeto, dame lo que es mío. No existe competición para tanta hipocresía. Somos barceros remando hacia nuestra propia deriva. Quien engaña no gana. Aquí quien engaña no gana. No gana. Quien engaña no gana. Y enemigo que huye, puente de plata. Que cada palo aguante su vela en esta cruzada. Fabricando color, voy levantando los andamiajes de la palabra y de la calle de la rima voy. Gris asfalto, coletas de imposibles. Y apagando candelas, tardan sueños invencibles. Dices que no hay nada nuevo bajo el sol. No que te cierro, hablar de lo que una no sabe. Trae mal agüero.
Quien engaña no gana. Aquí quien engaña no gana. Quien engaña no gana. Que aunque todos no la sabemos, nos la tragamos, nos la bebemos. Tú escoges, camino lento, llego y encuentro, o pisando rápido, tapa, trampa, grita, escapa, que yo paso. Te entrega chos y traperos, trepas y rumberos, y aquí yo me encuentro, tú me enchufas, dímelo, y yo te cuento.
Dentro llora, llueve, fuera llueve, duele, haciendo cola, buscando cola, aquí no existe ni inocente, aprovechando los favores del tiempo. Primavera llegará porque el invierno ya no puede madurar. Como el aire es el escudo de la tierra. Estrellas fugaces producidas por partículas menores que un grano de arena. Dejemos estela y emplémonos a fondo. Y en lo pequeño está la fuerza y yo respondo. Como el fuego, cambio continuo todo lo consume. Contemplar las tinieblas desde la tele se asume. Echando sapos y culebras por la boca. ¡Qué brota!
¿Qué si quieres oír tonterías? Cambia de día. ¿Qué si quieres oír realidades? Dime dónde vas, dime dónde estás. Relájate, siéntate y escucha.
pesan, lo cambian, lo pisan, lo pisan, lo quitan, lo tercen, lo compran, lo tiran, lo remueven y vuelta a empezar otra vez.